Hello, and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We are your hosts, Matt Levine.
And Vincent Hannum.
And we are talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts are welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com, hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. As Camp Kaiju says, stay campy, everybody. Thanks again for joining us tonight. Vincent, it's good to talk to you. Good to discuss the great film Them from 1954.
I am so excited to talk about this movie. I know you've been under the weather, but I'm glad you're feeling better and we could talk about this movie. I know we kind of left on a cliffhanger. Will we do Them? Will we do Frankenstein Conquers the World? Well, folks, fate has intervened. You get giant ants tonight.
Yes, and that is never a bad thing when you have giant ants on the menu, literally or figuratively.
Just as long as you bring your sugar cubes, then it'll go down all right.
That is a funny ongoing joke in the movie Them. I don't know if it's supposed to be a joke, but I found it hilarious.
I don't know either.
Rest assured, Frankenstein Conquers the World will still be coming up. We're going to be doing a partnership with a podcast called Frankenstein Minute. Check out that podcast. It is fantastic, so we're excited to have them on.
Matt and I met with the Frankenstein Minute, Bill and Tom. We had coffee with them. We sat down. We talked nonstop for 90 minutes about every monster movie under the sun. Universal stuff, Godzilla stuff. So it was just very encouraging for you and I, Matt, to be like, okay, this is going to be a good show. This is going to be an episode worth waiting for.
Indeed. And great, you know, company and great conversation that leads to a great podcast. So I'm looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to just talk about Patreon real quick. Ring-a-ding, everybody. So for $5 a month, you get access to great bonus material. Matt and I just wrapped up talking about Barbarian, Megan, some Kung Fu movies. So if you want to subscribe, you can get access to that conversation. Other tiers, we have two other tiers. For $10 a month, you get the bonus material and you get to suggest an episode for the show. So if you have a favorite monster movie that you really want us to cover and or you want to be on the show, $10 a month gives you that opportunity. For those who want even more, $15 a month, just for $15, you get all that and something called the Loyalty Program, where we deliver four items, merch. We're talking mugs, stickers, posters, tote bags over your first year of membership. So you pay $15 a month, you get cool merchandise with our exclusive Camp Kaiju artwork printed on it. So how about them apples?
Man, I want that. That sounds great. Where can I get one of those? I guess I have to be a patron. I will become a patron.
Thank you, Matt.
I'm just kidding. Yeah. Thank you again to our patrons. We really appreciate you. You know, your support helps Vincent and I pay for the podcast and pay for gear, helps pay for like special events that we have coming up. More info on that throughout 2023. So thank you again. We appreciate you very much.
Matt, is it Gamera Gong time?
I think it's Gamera Gong time, yeah.
Okay. You did it last time, so I'm going to ask if I can do it.
You absolutely should.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to roll up my sleeves.
Yeah.
Here we go. All right, I got some ants coming. Giant ants. I got to beat them back with the gong. Maybe it's a Wilhelm scream. I don't know. Okay, this is for Kelly, Chris, and Frank. Yeah.
Nice gonging, Vincent.
If I had a nickel for every time I heard that.
You would have 5 cents if that were the case.
that would get me nothing on Patreon.
No, sadly.
All right. Well, that was fun.
Yeah. I have another preview of what's coming up for Camp Kaiju. Soon, we will also be talking about the movie Jaws the Revenge. I will always remember that as the movie that Michael Caine, like, doesn't... I don't think he's ever even seen it, but he said that it, like, paid for his garage. So
for his whole house.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So I'm sure that will be part of the Jaws the Revenge episode. I also just wanted to plug our website real quick, which is campkaijumoviereviews.com. On that website, not only will you find links to all of the episodes of this podcast, you will also find additional reviews of movies that we haven't talked about. So make sure that you check that out for exclusive online content. So, yeah, Them. What are our personal histories with this film?
I've been watching Them since I was a kid. This is just one of those movies I fell in love with as a child. When DVDs became a thing in the early 2000s, this was one of my first DVDs. I still have that DVD, and it's what I watched it on a few weeks ago. It had been a while since I'd seen it, so I'd really forgotten. What rewatching it, I was like, oh, this is more than just your standard giant bug movie. There's like some really committed performances going on in this. And the script, too, is really tight. So I just love this movie. Always have, always will.
For whatever reason, like, some of the classic monster movies from the 50s kind of just passed me by when I was a kid. I never watched them when I was young. But I always wanted to see Them. I heard really good things about it. You know, a giant bug movie, you can never go wrong with that. I wanted to bring it to the podcast because I've been meaning to see it for, like, at least 10 years.
I was so excited when you revealed this to be one of your picks for the season.
Really, really happy to talk about this movie tonight. And as always, beware of spoilers on Camp Kaiju. Them starts with New Mexico State Police Sergeant Ben Peterson and Trooper Ed Blackburn as they discover a little girl in shock wandering the desert near Alamo Gordo. They discover a nearby trailer that's been almost destroyed and find evidence that the girl had been there when the trailer was attacked. It is later discovered that the trailer was owned by an FBI special agent named Ellison on vacation with his wife, son, and daughter, but the other members of the family still remain missing, except for the daughter. Now in an ambulance, the girl briefly reacts to a high-pitched sound coming from the desert by sitting upright, eyes open, on the stretcher.
At a general store owned by Gramps Johnson, Peterson and Blackburn find his dead body and a wall of the store partially obliterated. Peterson leaves Blackburn behind to secure the crime scene while he checks on the girl at the hospital. Blackburn goes outside to investigate the same high-pitched sound that he's now hearing. Gunshots are heard and Blackburn is killed off-screen. Peterson's captain later points out that both Johnson and Blackburn had fired weapons at their attacker. More puzzling is the coroner's report on Johnson's death, which finds a huge amount of formic acid in his body.
The FBI sends Special Agent Robert Graham to New Mexico to investigate. After a strange impression is found in the sand near the Ellison's trailer, the Department of Agriculture sends myrmecologists, Dr. Harold Medford, and his daughter, Dr. Pat Medford, to assist with the investigation. And if you know what myrmecologists are, you already have a big clue as to the story of Them. The elder Medford exposes the Ellison girl to formic acid fumes, which releases her from her catatonic state. She screams in panic and yells, "Them!" The doctors have a theory about what's causing all this, but don't want to reveal it prematurely.
At the Ellison campsite, Pat encounters a giant 8-foot-long ant. Following instructions from the elder Medford, Peterson and Graham shoot off the ant's antenna, blinding it, and kill it with a machine gun. Medford finally reveals his theory. A colony of giant ants mutated by radiation from the first atomic bomb test near Alamogordo is responsible for the deaths. General O'Brien orders an army helicopter search and the giant ant's nest is found. Cyanide gas bombs are tossed inside and Graham, Peterson, and Pat descend into the nest to check for survivors. Deep inside, Pat finds evidence that two queens have hatched and escaped to establish new colonies. The Medfords are alarmed by how quickly the giant ants could spread throughout the world.
Peterson, Graham, and the Medfords join a government task force that begins to investigate reports of unusual activity, including a pilot who was forced down by UFOs shaped like giant ants, or so he says, and a freighter in the Pacific with a giant queen hatching in one of the ship's holds. A third report of a large sugar robbery at a rail yard, after sugar had been found at the previous crime scenes, leads Peterson, Graham, and Major Kibbe to Los Angeles. Nearby, the mutilated body of a father is recovered, but his two young sons remain missing. Peterson, Graham, and Kibbe find evidence that they were flying a model airplane in the Los Angeles River drainage channel near a hospital. Martial law is then declared in Los Angeles, and troops are assigned to find the ants in the vast storm drains beneath the city.
Peterson finds the two missing boys alive, trapped by the ants near their nest. He calls for reinforcements and rescues both boys just before being attacked and killed by a giant ant's mandibles. Graham arrives with reinforcements and kills the ant, but other ants swarm to protect the nest. Graham and the soldiers fight them off, but a tunnel collapses on Graham, trapping him. Several ants charge, but he holds them off with his machine gun just long enough for troops to break through and save him. The queen and her hatchlings are discovered and destroyed with flamethrowers. As they burn, Dr. Medford offers a warning about the unknown horrors unleashed by the atomic age.
Boom, boom, boom. Yeah, I was surprised how kind of apocalyptic it seems at certain points. Like, it really does seem like giant ants are going to take over the entire planet at some point.
Yeah. Have you seen documentaries about ants in nature?
Well, there's kind of a documentary in this movie, a short film within the film. So I guess in that way I have.
Well, let me tell you, if you go like into the Amazon rainforest, the ground is just covered in ants, like bullet ants. These things are little soldiers in ant bodies, and their bites, they're not deadly, but if enough of them bite you, obviously you'll like go into shock. But they just like swarm. And when I watch them and I envision what I've seen on Animal Planet happening to the world, yeah, it's apocalyptic for sure.
Insects are, you know, kind of terrifying to me. That's one of my like unfounded phobias, spiders and insects. And like, it's, yeah, I mean, like if ants, you know, like various other insects were blown up to epic proportions, we'd be screwed. And obviously that's the kind of like appeal of this movie, you know, the kind of intensity of it.
And it's the numbers that get me. Like, the individual ants in this movie are killed rather easily by machine guns or flamethrowers. So it's not like, oh, just one giant ant. It's the numbers where their strength lies.
Right. And like, I think the dialogue scene where Dr. Medford is talking about how, you know, the adult queens can kind of just like float on the wind for like hundreds of miles and then like build a new nest somewhere else and then propagate and maybe have like hundreds or thousands of ants within a single nest. I was like, whoa, damn, like this is about to get out of hand really fast.
Sorry, you know what it reminded me of?
What's that?
Pandemic.
Yeah. And like, what do you do in the face of a pandemic? You're just screwed, you know?
Do you remember in the early COVID days where it was still only like overseas in China and you were like, huh, I wonder if and when that'll ever reach North America. And then there was one case in Seattle and you go, huh. And then the next day it just starts to grow and grow and grow, just like the ants.
It's kind of easy to forget now how kind of scary that was at first, you know, where you didn't really know what was happening. And then like the, you know, the, like the lockdown and the quarantine sort of directive came and you're like, wow, I guess this is a real thing. Like, I feel like most of us tried to like shut that possibility out of our minds, you know? So that is like a big reason why them is so, so frightening. Like the thought of that actually happening. Should we dive into the cast and crew a little bit?
There's so much to talk about with the cast and crew. This movie, I did not realize, has so many connections to just the broader film and entertainment history at, you know.
Totally, yeah. And a very like pedigreed group of people working on this movie. I was very, very impressed to read about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was directed by Gordon Douglas, who, you know, made movies for 50 plus years. He had a very, very long career. He worked in a lot of different genres. He made comedies like the early kind of like Our Gang, Little Rascals movies. He directed some of those. He made action B movies like Dick Tracy versus Cue Ball, which sounds awesome. I've never seen that, but I really want to now. Film noirs like Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye with Jimmy Cagney. He worked with stars like Elvis Presley on Follow That Dream, Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack on Robin and the Seven Hoods. So this guy got around, and he could maybe not master any genre, but do like very, very good, capable sort of director for hire work in a lot of them. So Them was produced by David Weisbart, who was a producer at Warner Brothers. In 1952, he became the youngest producer at Warner Brothers. He was only 37 years old. 1 year after Them, he produced the classic Rebel Without a Cause, one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a very, legendary in his own right producer, I would say. The cinematography is by Sidney Hickox, who worked at Warner Brothers for 27 years. I thought this was interesting. He eventually worked in TV, working on shows like I Love Lucy and The Andy Griffith Show, and helping to pioneer the three-camera sitcom technique.
Really?
Where you basically have a live studio audience and three cameras set up on the side of the stage. And other than that, it's sort of a live performance. And that kind of technique, the three cameras, would persist in TV for, you know, several decades afterwards. So he's kind of a pioneer in his own right.
Getting this cast together, these names were not big names at the time. Edmund Gwenn certainly was. He had won an Academy Award for playing Santa Claus in the original Miracle on 34th Street with Natalie Wood, who was in Rebel Without a Cause, bringing it full circle.
Love it when that happens.
No, Edmund Gwenn is a mouthful of a name, but also a really solid actor. He just has, like, I don't know, he like plays the befuddled old man really well, but at the same time brings a lot of heart and warmth to it. He also is known for his roles in four Alfred Hitchcock films, including Foreign Correspondent and The Trouble with Harry. So definitely a big name leading this cast.
His character in this movie is kind of like an early prototype of the, like, like quirky old scientist who provides a lot of exposition, you know? Like, I feel like we see that in so many monster movies since then. There's even a little bit of that in Piranha.
And that he is one example of those archetypes that Them establishes. So the rule book, if you will, was still being written for Atomic Age science fiction. And a character like Edmund Gwenn's all-knowing, exposition-filled doctor scientist, he's one of the originators for sure.
Like when we first are introduced to him in the movie, he sort of sounds like a leprechaun from the movie Leprechaun. Like he has a high-pitched voice and like an Irish brogue. And I wish I remember what his first line was. And I just like broke out laughing right away. Like, because that is such a familiar trope. But like you said, this kind of helped to build that trope. So yeah, it's cool to see that.
Yeah. And then alongside Edmund Gwenn, we have James Whitmore as Sergeant Peterson. Long film, TV, and theater career. And did you know he was only an Oscar short of an EGOT?
Whoa, I did not know that.
James Whitmore in Them is almost an EGOT winner, which is incredible.
We should lead the campaign for him to get an honorary Oscar, like posthumously, you know?
He had been nominated twice.
He was in some good movies. The Asphalt Jungle by John Huston. That's a fantastic movie. The original Planet of the Apes. He was in that as well as a lot of TV shows like The Twilight Zone.
Yeah, yeah. And okay, so he was nominated in 1949 for a movie called Battleground. He won a Tony Award for playing Harry Truman in a one-man show in 1975 called Give 'Em Hell, Harry. He won the Grammy Award for voicing, for like doing a recording of that play. And then he was nominated for another Oscar, I guess, for a film adaptation of Give 'Em Hell, Harry.
Oh, so it's all about that, basically.
Yeah.
If it weren't for Give 'Em Hell, Harry, he would not be an EGOT, or almost an EGOT, but still pretty impressive.
Yeah. He found his thing.
Yeah. Yeah. A one-man Harry Truman show was his thing.
Yeah.
Nice.
But he is very good in Them. I think he brings a real sort of an everyman presence while presenting as like a tough guy.
Yeah.
He's really kind of a big softy, and I really like that in him.
Me too. He underplays very, very well. He's the kind of actor where, like, it seems like he's not even acting, but he still has like a lot of charisma and like gravity, you know?
Yeah. Opposite him as the FBI agent is James Arness. I did not realize I was watching James Arness in this film because I know him from The Thing from Another World,
Yeah.
where he plays the thing and he's all, gussied up in makeup and prosthetics.
Yeah, and he's very well known from TV shows like Gunsmoke and How the West Was Won. Also, a Minneapolis native. Gotta throw out the Twin Cities connection.
I didn't know that. Did you know that?
As of like 3 hours ago, I didn't know that because I found that out of my research today. Before that, I did not know.
Fair enough. Is it too much to ask? Do you know where he's from in Minneapolis?
That I don't know. Sorry.
We have to find out and go to his place of birth.
Okay.
Because, like, all joking aside, Gunsmoke ran for 20 years.
Yeah, he was a huge star. Definitely a huge TV star. Like, I feel like there was a point in time where, like, everybody, most Americans knew his name, I feel like his character in Them is pretty detestable. Like, he's very, very unlikable, I think.
Who he's the worst to is our female protagonist, Dr. Pat Medford. She's played by Joan Weldon, who had at this time was known as primarily as a singer. She had a brief film and TV career. So yeah, Them is her best known movie, but I thought she totally held her own, and I really loved her character.
Interesting. I did not like her character all that much, but I think she gives a very good performance considering the weaknesses of the role. Like, I feel like it's pretty underwritten, but she manages to bring some originality to it.
Yes, it is not as well written as it could be, but after you watch so many science fiction monster movies from the 1950s, it's very common for women to play damsel in distresses. Even women who are cast as doctors and scientists in lesser films, they still only just play the damsel in distress, and it's just kind of like an obligatory title that they have. Oh, the scientist. But in Them, she continually brushes off Graham's advances. Like, he's hitting on her hardcore, and she's always ignoring him. She's always brushing him off. She's like a woman with a job, very no nonsense. And they never got together at the end the way you'd think they would. I find that refreshing.
Yeah, that's all a valid point for sure. I thought it was weird that she was supposed to be this great myrmecologist, is that what they're called? Like this great, yeah, great like ant scientist. And yet it's always her dad who gives this like expositional information. There may be a couple short scenes where she's like, here's a trivia fact about ants, but that's like kind of all she does. And it was like seems a little bit disappointing, but like yeah, you're totally right that she like one of my probably my favorite scene with her is when she's like adamant that she is going to go down into the nest to see if there are any like surviving ants down there. And the FBI agent is like, oh, you're a woman, you can't do that. And she's like, no, screw you, I'm going down there. Like that
Yeah.
scene is great for sure.
And she does. But you're right too. Like, maybe it's just because it's early in the genre, but it's like, oh, you are the archetype of strong female scientists to come. Because there are other examples, like Creature from the Black Lagoon, which actually came out before them. But there's a better example of a stronger female scientist character in the one woman who goes into the Black Lagoon. But yeah, I agree with you too.
That's a fair point. Yeah, I mean, like, it's I'm probably speaking from presentism a little bit and like, what I want female characters to look like in like modern movies, but this movie's from 1954, so probably was a little bit more forward thinking in that regard.
Yeah. There are some fun little cameos in this movie. I did not know Leonard Nimoy was in this until about 3 hours ago. It's got to be a blink and you miss him part, right?
Yeah, I think so. Although when I watched this last night, he does have one line of dialogue. I think he just like gives a report and is like, "Here's the last known location." And I was like, "That voice sounds so familiar. Like, where do I know that guy from?" I think that was Leonard Nimoy. Yeah,
He's really young. Like, it's at least 10 years before Star Trek.
for sure. Yeah, and yeah, like I didn't recognize him, by looking at him. I think only, yeah, from the voice, I was like, "That sounds weirdly familiar," but I didn't know that it was him until I did more research today. So.
Cool.
Yeah, an early rule.
And another big bit of trivia with this film that I am not aware of, but I appreciate it, is an actor named Fess Parker. He plays a really great role, actually. A Texas pilot who's placed in a mental institution because he's claiming he has seen giant ants, and the government, to keep panic at bay, places him in a mental institution. And Fess Parker played this role so well that Disney, Walt Disney, saw his performance and from them cast Parker as Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone in the long-running and very popular TV shows in the 50s.
Yeah, it's a cool connection. And his performance in this movie is fantastic. Like, when we see that scene with Alan, I was like, man, who is this guy? Like, he's bringing so much personality and humor and kind of a weird sort of vulnerability to the role. He's great, and he has like probably like 2 minutes of screen time, so
yeah,
I understand why Disney would have been impressed, because I was as well. So yeah, really, you know, a great cast, again, like a very capable crew, lots of talent behind the camera and in front of the camera for this movie.
BanditsEmporium.com is the official t-shirt partner of Camp Kaiju. Check out BanditsEmporium.com or hit the link in our bio to check out their selection of monster-inspired tees. Part of their proceeds go to supporting this very show. So visit BanditsEmporium.com. Whatever your style, they have you covered. As they say, we sell shirts. And as Camp Kaiju says, we have a new shirt alert, everybody. This is all original. It's in the style of like a Pacific Rim mech.
Yeah, I was thinking Mega Man from the video games personally.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, yeah, I could see that.
I can't wait to get one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Warner Brothers put them into production to kind of emulate the shock value of their previous hit, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, which maybe, Vincent, I feel like maybe you could talk about this a little bit more, but perhaps that kind of kickstarted like the 50s monster movie craze a little bit.
It did. Gojira is obviously the most famous example. Them preceded Gojira by several months, actually. However, preceding them was The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, about a dinosaur that is awoken in our modern age from nuclear testing in the Antarctic, I believe. No, or the Arctic. One of the polar caps. And it had special effects by Ray Harryhausen. So everyone honestly should go see The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. It like slowly ushered in atomic giant monster movies, but it was overshadowed by them and then Gojira.
That's a movie I've been wanting to see also for years. And I imagine we probably will talk about it on the podcast at some point.
Yeah, no, it's a essential viewing for kaiju fans for sure.
Yeah, so again, Warner Brothers put them into production to kind of imitate the success of The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. It was originally supposed to be in color and 3D, so this was kind of seen as like a big, you know, blockbuster that they were going to do. That ended up not being the case, partially because Warner Brothers' 3D camera rig malfunctioned right before the production of them. So they kind of scrapped those plans. I think also just to save production costs, they scrapped those plans. However, the opening title of them is still in color. It's the only moment where it's like bright red and then everything is black and white from that point on.
Yeah. And you can see some of the 3D shots in even in 2D. And you don't realize this because it's still really effective. I feel like at the end when they're shooting the ants with flamethrowers, the flamethrowers are pointed right at the camera. And now you think, oh, that makes sense if it was supposed to be in 3D. In 2D, it still works, though. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, totally agree. There's another really bizarre composition where the FBI agent Graham is like staring directly at the camera and he's wearing goggles and there's like a sandstorm behind him. And he says something, I forget the exact line, like directly to the camera. And when I saw that, I was like, this is such a weird composition. Why would you like shoot it this way? And I feel like maybe that's why. Maybe that was supposed to be a 3D image to start with.
Creature from the Black Lagoon was released earlier in 1954. Same exact thing. It was actually released in 3D. But when you watch it in 2D, there are shots that are clearly meant for 3D, but still work just as well in 2D.
I think that there's also a moment in Friday the 13th 3D, which I know I mentioned before, I hate those movies, but there's kind of a funny moment. I think it's where a guy's head is squeezed and his eyes pop out like directly at the audience, you know? And I did see that movie in 3D once, and it was really hilarious and ridiculous. But like to see it in 2D, it's almost funnier to just see this weird shot of like a guy's eyes popping out and kind of just like hanging in midair, you know? So yeah, it leads to some like really weird images when that happens. So yeah, Them was filmed in various parts of California, including the concrete spillways of the Los Angeles River east of downtown, as well as the Mojave Desert. The giant ants were painted a purple-green color and were constructed and operated by technicians that were supervised by Ralph Ayers. So clearly the ants in this movie were, you know, large puppets. They were not, you know, like this movie doesn't use a lot of like, or really any, as far as I could tell, superimposition or rear projection or anything like that. It's not suitmation like you might see in like a Toho Studios film. But the puppets work pretty well for the most part, I would say.
Yeah, I don't think they're as convincing, like in hindsight. But I think shooting it in black and white helps. And I think some of the angles they're shot at helps. Keeping them in shadows really helps too. Yeah, they're fun. They're not, they don't distract me.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely wouldn't say they're convincing, but they are sort of like, yeah, I mean, like, I think the visual style when we see them is, yeah, like you said, like really effective. Like when the first time that we see an ant, when it kind of like very quietly kind of like crawls over a sand dune, when Pat, the female doctor, is kind of like hunkering down and she doesn't see it at first, extremely effective scene. And it's not necessarily because of the special effects or the puppet work. It's mostly because of the composition and the sound design and the editing.
Definitely compensates for any dated sort of cheesy monster effects.
Yeah, totally. There's really great sound design. The sound effect of the kind of shrieking ants consisted of bird-voiced tree frogs mixed in with the calls of various birds. So it's really effective. Like, I feel like the sound in this movie is actually one of the most intense and kind of creepy parts of it. So they did a great job with that.
Yeah.
On a similar note, the Wilhelm scream, which you mentioned before, Vincent, it's just one of my favorite things in the history of cinema. Like every time I hear it, I break out laughing, and I could detect three cases of the Wilhelm scream in Them, and yep, it's hilarious every time.
Once you know what that scream is, you can't not hear it when it's presented in a movie. Even modern movies released today, I'll whatever blockbuster it is, I'll hear it still.
Yeah, I love it every time. It's so charming. Yeah, I sort of recently rewatched Rambo First Blood Part 2, which is just such a dumb and awesome and amazing, ridiculous movie. But like the Wilhelm scream is all over the place in that movie. It's awesome. I know that's not super recent. That was from the 80s, but still pretty cool.
No, but yeah, it's like such a cliche for film nerds. So when you see it used earnestly in Them or Star Wars or Indiana Jones, you're just like, oh, okay, that they're using it seriously. Okay. It's a good scream.
It is, yeah. It's immediately recognizable once you know what it is. I love it.
Yeah, that's fun.
All right, so Them made $2 million in 1954, making it the year's 51st biggest earner. It wasn't a huge hit, but it was the biggest hit for Warner Brothers that year, depending on the source. Yeah, I saw that note too. There were two other Warner Brothers movies that were listed as higher in like a different publication, but depending on who you talk to, Them was Warner Brothers' highest grossing movie of the year.
But you know what it tells me, though? If that was only the 51st highest grossing movie of the year total, it doesn't sound like Warner Brothers had a great year.
Yeah, it does not seem like it. Yeah. I mean, probably MGM was still like the most powerful studio around that time, I would guess, but I could be wrong about that. But I was kind of surprised to read that.
I mean, the early 50s, it is really interesting. Like, if we do want to talk about why 3D even exists, it's because at this time, TV was the thing. And studios were looking for anything to get people in the movie theaters. So big bugs, big action movies, color and 3D were the things. So maybe it was just a bad year for studios in general.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yeah, TV, and also there was a court decision in the late 40s where studios had to like disband their like huge conglomerates or whatever, because they used to be able to like own movie theaters and distribution companies and the production companies. And so there was like an anti-monopoly suit that came down that said that they had to like disband and like divest a lot of those properties. So yeah, it's a great point. You're totally right that studios were maybe not doing all that well in the early 50s and trying to find ways to survive financially.
Yeah, it's a really interesting period of time for film history.
Especially because, you know, like politically, of course, like the country was in kind of like a turbulent era as well, like with, you know, the Cold War, obviously, which them talks about frequently. You know, you have McCarthyism and the kind of like paranoia over communism.
Well, you had the Blacklist too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, an era of Hollywood filmmaking where there was a lot going on behind the scenes that would kind of endanger the studios and kind of leave them very vulnerable. So I don't know. Them connects to that in a lot of ways, both explicitly and implicitly, I would say.
I'll read this review from the Monthly Film Bulletin. It was a review at the time which compared it favorably to other films in the relatively new sci-fi genre, which often featured clunky, unrealistic special effects. Anyways, the Monthly Film Bulletin wrote that the ants are, quote, reasonably horrible. They do not entirely avoid the impression of mock-up that is almost inevitable when over life-size creatures have to be constructed and moved, but they were considerably more convincing than those prehistoric remnants that have recently been emerging from bog and iceberg. So that is clearly a reference to the beast from 20,000 fathoms coming out of the iceberg there, which was stop motion animation. So if we're looking at the beast from 20,000 fathoms, used stop motion, them used puppetry, and Gojira uses suitmation. Take your pick. I think there are pros and cons to all methods.
Yeah, for sure. Do you think the reference to the bog, do you think that's a reference to Creature from the Black Lagoon, possibly?
Yes.
Yeah, which would, and that would have been suitmation kind of as well, right?
Well, that was, I don't know. I don't know, I guess, the definition of suitmation, but it was a suit, but the suit is so form-fitting, it's like a costume more than a, in my mind, anyways.
It is interesting, and it's just cool to see like a review that came out when the actual film came out that's kind of talking about like other sci-fi movies around the same time, because it makes you realize that like you know, we have this conversation nowadays of like this great group of sci-fi movies that came out around this time, but they were, you know, talking about similar things back then in different ways, of course, and like viewing them in different ways. But yeah, it's cool to kind of get this firsthand account of when this genre was first becoming extremely popular.
Yeah, and this was still quite new. The Day the Earth Stood Still came out in 1951. That was kind of like the first big sci-fi movie. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms came out in 1953. And then really, 54 was when you had them and the Creature from the Black Lagoon and Godzilla.
Right. Maybe the best year for science fiction, like in all of cinema, possibly.
I would argue that. And then from there, I mean, the rest was history. You had so many classic good and bad movies in the genre.
Yeah, you know, when I read like, oh, like sci-fi really was like a young genre in the 50s, I was trying to think of earlier examples, and really like one of the few that I could think of was Metropolis, the Fritz Lang movie from 1927. But aside from that, like I, you know, I get, yeah, you have some movies that are more like fantasy, maybe, like The Lost World, the silent version of The Lost World and stuff like
Yeah,
that. But
or King Kong.
yeah, totally. But yeah, I mean, like that makes sense to me. Like aside from Metropolis, yeah, it probably was the 50s where this genre really kind of came into its own, you know?
If you like giant bug movies, Tarantula, I would highly recommend. Black Scorpion or the Deadly Mantis. And those three are often bundled with them as like the pillars of giant bug movies from the 50s.
I cannot wait to watch those.
Yeah, Tarantula's great. Jack Arnold directed it, who directed Creature from the Black Lagoon,
Oh, yeah.
The Incredible Shrinking Man. Yeah, top tier talent. Tarantula's fun.
I should see that. I'm, like I mentioned before, I'm scared of spiders, but maybe that will make me get over my fear. It's probably, I would imagine it's not like actually scary, but I could be wrong. Who knows?
It's just one giant spider.
Okay. Well, I'll, you know, steel myself, I'll work up my courage, and I will watch it someday. So to finish up our kind of discussion of the production and the backstory of the film. So when it was released in 1954, it was nominated for a Best Special Effects Oscar, but lost to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, another very influential sci-fi kind of fantasy movie from the time. And even though it did get pretty positive reviews when it first came out, I would say that that kind of retrospective opinion has become even more adulatory, more glowing since then. Like, this is really seen as a classic of the era nowadays.
Yeah, the big overarching theme of them are the horrors of the atomic age. I would also add the wonders of the atomic age. At this point, like, early sci-fi was full of fear for atomic energy, but also like a kind of a curiosity, maybe a morbid curiosity of like, I don't know, can ants become giant sized? Like, nobody knew exactly what radioactivity did to things. They knew it was something terrible, something to be feared, but the science was anyone's guess. So I think them plays into that. Like, the last lines of the film are really poetic, and he says, "When man entered the atomic age, he opened the door to a new world. What we may eventually find in that new world, nobody can predict."
Yeah, I could see that for sure. At the same time, I feel like we have these like apocalyptic moments because of these giant ants. Like, the entire world could go to hell in less than a year. Like, these things could spread everywhere. And in addition to that, like, I feel like there's kind of like a streak of, maybe anti-Americanism is a strong word, but I feel like it was probably as like subversive as it could be for 1954. That's how I read it anyway. There's a line where one character says, "Has the Cold War gotten hot?" Thinking that maybe like the Soviet Union has like created these monsters and like flown in the ants or whatever, you know? And then another character says, "No, we did it to ourselves." So I feel like there's a streak where the movie is saying like, we have brought this upon ourselves. And there are some other ways where I think the movie kind of like suggests that a little bit, but I definitely understand what you're saying about like the wonder of the atomic age. But I also was struck by how, especially in the midst of like the Red Scare and McCarthyism and like people needing to prove that they're patriotic and love capitalism and stuff like that, the movie does seem kind of like critical of what the United States has done in terms of like the atomic bomb testing in New Mexico and like implicitly dropping the atomic bombs in Japan, which, you know, the movie doesn't specifically reference that, but that's obviously like the implication hovering over the whole thing, you know?
It's so interesting because I agree with you. If it's not subversively anti-American, it's definitely, I would argue, subversively anti-government.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the, like, there's a reason why Graham, the FBI agent, is so unlikable. It just plays into like, okay, we have the FBI. It's like the government agency that everybody knows. J. Edgar Hoover, you know?
Yeah.
Still, he's like a cult hero. Like, people know the FBI. And then James Arness comes in and he's utterly incompetent. He doesn't know really what to do. He's just like every other government official and general, just kind of making it up as they go. Listening to the science, they have to listen to the civilians on how to face this threat. So on the one hand, you have the army save the day. But on the other hand, there's a subversive streak, to your point.
You know, more on the subject of Agent Graham, if I can talk a little bit more about like why I think he's so unlikable. Like, you know, they talk to the what's his name? Fess Parker, that character, the pilot who's like put in the mental institution. And he's a very sympathetic character. He like tells his, you know, what happened to him. Like, he was flying and he saw these giant ants, and now he's like been locked up in this insane asylum. And he's like, "Please get me out of here." And like immediately Agent Graham is like, "You can't leave. Like, we are going to lock you up here because you cannot spread panic about this," you know? So we already kind of hate him there. He's, you know, very sexist towards the Dr. Pat Medford character. That's another example. And then at the end of the movie, when Sergeant Peterson, who has, you know, like, they have a pretty good rapport, they kind of seem like friends and partners throughout the film, Sergeant Peterson is killed by an ant. And to me, like, the way I read it, like, Agent Graham hardly bats an eye. Like, he doesn't really seem to care at all about his friend dying. Like, it seems to me that the movie is very intentionally saying, like, this is a heartless, emotionless, you know, pretty callous son of a bitch. Mm-hmm. And like, he's an FBI agent. Like, I feel like the movie is saying, these are the people that are looking out for you, and they're sort of detestable, you know?
Yes, I agree. To talk about The Day the Earth Stood Still again, there, these two movies present the government as the, on the one hand, they present it as the institution that's going to keep us safe, which was the belief in the 1950s. It took the counterculture revolution and Vietnam to blow that mythology up. But the fact was, people trusted the government post-World War II. Why wouldn't you? But movies like Them and The Day the Earth Stood Still show those moments of government overreach where they are going to keep a man who's telling the truth, and they know he's telling the truth, locked up in an institution for, quote, the greater good, but at the expense of this man's civil liberties and his freedom.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, there's the whole saying, like, better one guilty person to go free than one innocent person to be locked up. That's like the supposedly like the kind of myth of America or whatever, you know. But like, how Agent Graham behaves in this movie totally like contradicts that. It like gives credence to that lie, you know, like innocent people are kind of oppressed or locked up all the time. So
yeah,
it's, and you're right that like The Day the Earth Stood Still is another great example of that. So yeah, I, like, it's cool to see sci-fi movies like this kind of resisting the system a little bit as much as they could.
Right. The army does come in and kick some butt at the end, but the people pulling the levers behind the scenes, big government, what are you doing?
Totally. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And there's, you know, I think there's also, you know, Dr. Medford, the elder Dr. Medford also kind of makes this point on kind of like a larger existential scale, I guess you could say, when he says, ants are the only animals besides man that make war. They campaign, they're chronic aggressors, they make slave laborers. It's a pretty remarkable dialogue scene, I think, because the doctor is saying, you know, you think these ants are savage and barbaric and ruthless. Well, they're just taking after man, you know? And yeah, so that's that theme is maybe a little on the nose, but I still like that scene a lot.
Yeah, I appreciated the explicit nature of that dialogue. Because in a movie like this, sometimes if you try to be too subtle, the messaging might get lost. So just lay it on the line.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, the visual style is not very flashy in this movie, but I would say it's very, very solid. Like, it doesn't call attention to itself, but in the manner of a lot of great Hollywood movies from this time, it is telling the story as effectively and efficiently as possible, is how I would put it. I also think that there are a few shots that are very striking, that kind of seem a little bit abnormal, like, or among movies from this time in the Hollywood era, or the classical Hollywood era, I should say. There's a really great opening aerial shot where there's like a shot taken from a plane or maybe a helicopter, and like we see a plane below that and then a car even further below that driving through the desert, and there's like all this shrubbery that is casting like very extreme shadows in the desert. It's a great way to open the movie. Really, really spectacular opening shot, I think. There are a lot of good examples of kind of like striking compositions which come out of nowhere. I'll just kind of say a couple more of them here. I really love the scene in which a government agent, I think it's a general, is kind of giving an emergency broadcast about the ants. And we see a lot of different people that are watching the broadcast on various TVs. But at the same time, military jeeps are kind of like driving through cities all across America. So there are some really strange shots where, you know, there's the emergency broadcast on a TV in the background, and then a bunch of just like average civilians that are maybe watching the TV or maybe watching these jeeps roll by. It's a weird contradiction to me, because, you know, having an emergency broadcast where the military is saying like, there are giant ants, stay in your homes, is like, seems a little cheesy and ridiculous. But then we have these kind of ominous images of like martial law and like soldiers like overtaking these cities. That scene was really, really well done, I think. And it takes something that could be kind of absurd and makes it weirdly kind of realistic. Like, if this happened in real life, that probably is how it would play out, you know?
Felt very immediate. And maybe it's just with all the turmoil in Minneapolis in the past couple of years, it's just like, yeah, suddenly I wasn't watching a big bug movie. Yeah, it was good use of, I don't know, maybe action to create tension.
That's a good, you know, I'm glad that you brought up, you know, like real world kind of like conflicts, protests, things that have gone on, especially in the Twin Cities over the last couple of years, because like I feel like this scene in Them is another way to say like, look at how easily like your rights could be taken away by the military. Like, they could, you know, just take over your city, you know, within a day, like at the drop of a hat or whatever. So it's a scary thought. Like, giant bugs are kind of a scary thought, but like your world being taken over by the military, even more terrifying. You mentioned before that like the maybe not so great puppet work, or like at least not convincing, was made up for by like some really great shots and visual style. My favorite example of that is when they're in like the drainage tunnel beneath Los Angeles, and we're looking down into a pit, and there are these three giant ants that suddenly just like appear out of the dark. That is a scary image. Like, no matter how like unconvincing the puppets are, it's shadowy, it's unexpected, and like, you know, imagining coming across those things in like a sewer is a pretty terrifying thought.
The whole finale in the sewers is, I think, just extraordinary with the action and the editing and the special effects. Yeah, those ants jump out at you. And when Peterson dies, I was, my mouth was agape. I didn't expect him to die because he's so likable, and he gets crushed by an ant. And then James Arness, he gets inadvertently cornered by a bunch of ants, and it happens so quick, the action and the editing. I felt as trapped and cornered as he did all of a sudden. And you could see the panic on his face, and he's like, oh shit, this is it. But then he survives. But yeah, I think the action is so well done in this movie.
And I was thinking of how difficult it must have been. Like, there are some shots in like the drainage tunnels where like we see Jeeps driving, and like just the lighting and the camera work, and how difficult it must have been to like set up those shots. Mm-hmm. Like, clearly this is a production that had a lot of resources and money at its disposal. And you know, it's worth it. Like, it's really exciting. Like you said, it's extremely well made. It's a great finale for sure. That's all I really wanted to say about the form and the aesthetic. Again, the sound design is really fantastic. I loved it. Just like the sounds of like the chirping ants and like the howling wind and the sand and that sandstorm early on. Really, really effective. So overall, very, very solid style in this movie. Well, should we get into the breakdown? The good, the bad, and the campy?
I love the pacing and the characters. All super compelling. I love the begin. So I love the structure of this script is a classic three-act structure. In the first 30 minutes, you have the setup leading until they discover the first ant colony. Then it's like, oh crap, the queens are out. End act one. Act two, 30 minutes of like boardroom talk and ant show documentary. No joke. And then the last 30 minutes is all in Los Angeles battle under the streets. So good. So tight. In the beginning, I have to shout out the little girl. Her performance, like when I was a kid, it was frightening. And she's just in this catatonic state that is, because of the sound design too, is just really chilling.
I think it still is very creepy. Like, there were some moments that really unnerved me. They're very eerie. You know, I was gonna bring up the little girl too. I feel like that's the only time that a little kid in like a Hollywood movie from this era has actually been scary. There are like a lot of horror movies kind of about that, like The Bad Seed, for example, but this one actually works. So I loved that. I love the scene at Gramps Johnson, the store. Like, I feel like all that stuff is really well done. Mm-hmm. Especially when they like lift up the trapdoor and like they see his corpse in the basement.
Yeah.
Really unexpected. Yeah. Just at the point where you think that like the ant attacks are starting to get a little bit repetitive, then it switches to like act two with like the boardroom talk and all that, like you mentioned, the ant documentary. And you know, the fact that they're like flying queen ants, that like brings in a new sort of like wrinkle into the plot. So yeah, the story is very unpredictable. It really keeps you on your toes and is frequently still scary even to this day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What didn't you like about the movie?
I felt bad for the ants. Like, I, you know, I'm a vegetarian, and I'm an ethical vegetarian, and I, you know, care about animals. So obviously they're puppets. They're not real ants, but to see them like, you know, killed with like machine guns and flamethrowers over and over again, it's like, man, I kind of want these ants to kill the humans. Like, I want them to be victorious, you know? I'm sort of joking, but not really. I would say that like maybe the second part of the movie, the boardroom sort of scenes where the military is trying to figure out what's going on and plotting their strategy, maybe drags a little bit at times. It can be a little bit dialogue heavy in that section. But then like we have this great finale in the sewers to kind of, you know, bring the excitement back. So that's all I got. I don't really have too many criticisms.
Yeah, it's so tight. It's just nitpicking at this point. But I also thought if I had to pick something, that middle portion, it doesn't drag. Don't get me wrong. I don't think it drags. I think, though, if you're going into a monster movie and you're not expecting so much just conversation about the monsters, you could think it drags. But if you appreciate script writing and performances, it's just as good, just as compelling. And you get a really fun science lesson in ant studies.
I do love that. Yeah, the film within the film where they watch that whole educational film about ants. I loved that. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. I feel like that's a burn against me because I just said that part of the movie drags a little bit. But that's totally fair.
You just don't appreciate script writing or performances.
Obviously, yeah. What about the campy? What do you got?
Throughout the film, James Whitmore, he's just like a state police officer. And yet somehow by the end of the film, he has managed his way into the army or like the FBI. And now he's way outside his jurisdiction. I don't know what strings he pulled. He would not still be with this story if this was real life, right? I found that to be really funny and charming. Like, oh, he's still there.
For me, it's kind of just like a couple particular lines that I thought were pretty campy. The FBI agent, Graham, when he first meets this beautiful female doctor, Dr. Medford, he says, if she's the kind of doctor who takes care of sick people, I'll get a fever real fast. Yeah, like, I feel like I started to hate him at that exact moment. Like, and then so this part, I don't know if it's campy. I think it's actually intentionally very funny, but there's the crime scene where the ants steal like 40 tons of sugar and they like, they go to this rail yard where the sugar was stolen from. And a rail employee is like, why is this FBI guy here? Like, why would he care about a crime like this? And the cop says, oh, he's got a real sweet tooth. Which is like such a dumb but actually hilarious joke. Like, I really burst out laughing at that moment. I love it. All right. Well, we have four ratings here on Camp Kaiju. Our top rating, it is a timeless classic and stands the test of time. Our second highest, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Third, we have it may be historically significant or just fun, but does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time. I think you've convinced me. I was leaning this way in any case, but Them is a timeless classic. It stands the test of time. For me, it's one of the greatest monster movies that I've seen from the 50s, definitely from Hollywood. And I loved it.
Hands down, I think it's a classic. I think it stands the test of time because it does take itself so seriously. And just the inspiration for everything that's come after this. Like, there's even a part, you remember in the first nest or the second nest, they discover the eggs of the ants. And inside you see baby ants.
Yeah.
That's so creepy and gross. Yeah. And it made me think of Alien. Just like any monster movie where you see things inside a cocoon.
It's pretty terrifying, pretty gross. Yeah, and really well done.
And I think maybe even ahead of its time. Like, I just feel like that's an image so gnarly for the early 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's creepy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Thank you all for hanging out. If you liked what you hear, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com. Visit us on Instagram or Patreon for more monster movie content. We can't thank you enough. Camp Kaiju was recorded in the Twin Cities with music by Terrence Jackson. Before I forget, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com, hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. And as Camp Kaiju says, thanks again, friends. Until next time, stay campy.
This flag here at Los Angeles indicates a lead. Mr. Graham and Sergeant Ben Peterson are there now. They were flown west by Major Kibbe to check a rather large sugar theft, 40 tons to be exact.